Mike Nigley is my guest for this episode of Climate Champions. He is an inspiring, dynamic leader, and I had the pleasure of working on Mike's team when he was COO and president of SDG&E during the formation and successful run of the Smart Grid team. Among other board positions, Mike is the chairman of the board of ESS, a flow battery energy storage company. They are on a very successful run right now, but I'll let Mike tell you all about it. Mike Nigley, welcome to Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, as you know, and I'm very excited to talk to you about climate change and your role in it and how you're a champion. So to start off, please tell me about ESS and how that's going.
I'd be glad to, Lee. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast. First of all, ESS Inc. Stands for Energy Storage Systems. A company that was founded in 2011, and what we did was essentially for about 5-6 years, the founders of the company were developing the product. This is an iron flow battery, an iron flow battery system that we like to think is the cleanest energy storage battery on the planet. And we're very happy about that. We generally serve industrial, commercial, and utility applications. We don't do residential. And we also don't do mobile applications such as vehicles kind of thing. We are a long duration storage company. Our sweet spot is between 3 and 8 hours of duration. And the really great thing is that with a flow battery, you have unlimited cycling. Not only do you have unlimited cycling, I mean, this is a workhorse battery, you have zero degradation. So there is never any situation where the performance degrades. And what's really nice, it's a 25-year product. We have guarantees that we give customers for 25 years. We're just going into the commercialization phase now. And some of the things we found that customers are very interested in, frankly, is the fact that we have zero hazardous chemicals. So our entire battery, when you get to 25 years or more, is recyclable. And you don't have to worry about any hazardous materials on the permitting side. So we're pretty happy about this. We have a segmentation that really doesn't compete with lithium ion in most situations. We have our own segments. And just recently, we've acquired a guarantee from Munich Re that will guarantee our products for 10 years. And that's going to make the opportunity for financial opportunities for people for banking and loans essentially going to have a terrific opportunity for them to buy our products from that standpoint. So we're in the commercialization period now, and we're ramping up pretty rapidly.
What I like about your product is that the megawatt hour is so reasonably priced. And so from my perspective, we had wave one, which was solar, and you basically connect it and it makes energy and you don't have to have a lot of management of it or think about how to use it. Then you have shorter term batteries, which I think are good for managing power quality. And you have software, which you need the software piece. But without the long-term storage, you can't go very long before you have to connect back up to a grid if you have a microgrid or have a traditional thermal generator that has, basically it is using long-term storage. It's using natural gas or it's using coal or it's using propane, right? But those are all forms of long-term storage.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's been very interesting because you can use the grid for storage in some places too, but we're in the final stages of signing some contracts for some fairly good-sized microgrids with electric companies on different continents. And what we're finding is there's a lot of places where people want to actually displace the diesel that they have. So one of the deals we'll probably have over the next several weeks is a microgrid that has excess hydroelectric that's being dumped right now. They're using diesel and they need long-term storage. And so we're going to be in a situation where putting in a few of our batteries is going to allow them to shut down all of their diesel units for at least 8 months a year.
Wow.
And If we add a couple more, we could probably shut down their entire diesel component for the entire year. And I've got to tell you, this is the kind of thing that long duration storage was absolutely made for. And that's the kind of applications that we think will bring customers tremendous value.
I totally agree. I think in places where you have a lot of diesel generation, even if you don't get to zero diesel, the amount of money you save in diesel fuel using the same engines you already have, but just using them so much more efficiently and so much less, all you need are batteries and renewable energy, and you're at 90% renewables.
Absolutely. And you know what we found too is that a lot of the storage that requirements for people who are in the solar area, they're really looking at the 4 hour plus. So if they're in the 4 hour area, it starts to be one of the real great sweet spots. But I've got to tell you, the thing that's got us excited is the more complex your situation, the more valuable our battery is, because we have unlimited cycling and we have no performance degradation. So if you're in a situation where you have any kind of a grid requirement for solar, wind, hydro, implementation of some diesel or some other fossil fuel, we can integrate all of that and optimize everything. And you can't do that with the short-term batteries. The other interesting thing that's I think people don't think about is that when they think long duration, they don't necessarily think about ancillary services. Our battery performs everything that a lithium-ion battery can do in terms of ancillary services. So you're not missing out. You get all the short-term performance, but you get the long-term energy with respect to the marketplace.
One thing that I've hoped for a long time would be a flow battery that works, that can store a large amount of the liquid, so that instead of going 4 hours or 8 hours or 12 hours, you could actually leave it there over the course of the summer when you're generating a lot of it, and then maybe take it out winter, like natural gas.
Yeah, no, that's a great point.
Is that a fantasy?
No, it's not. It's actually a reality with this particular battery. And the reason I say that, and it's great you brought up that question, because the type of battery we have, we store the energy in the electrolyte. So if we have stored the energy and you unplug us, you can come back literally months later, plug it back in, and it's ready to go to deliver the energy you've stored. So the question the customer has to answer is, how much energy do you want and how long do you store it? So there's a tremendous resiliency factor that goes along with that. And if for some reason you need it for multi-cycles during the day, you just turn it on and it is a workhorse. So we're finding that in some operations in some other continents where they may have large-scale mining operations and they really need backup, they're actually thinking about batteries like this to store energy for a long period of time and then use it when they need it.
Any idea when you might have the concept of a tank that could supply the electrolytes? You don't have to say it if you don't know or don't want to, but is that something that's on the roadmap?
Well, we actually have a tank right now. The real question is, what size do you want? Our tank, our mobile solutions, which are standard containers, they're 40 foot by 8 foot by 8 foot. They come in 50 kilowatt or 100 kilowatt size, and they all come in 400 kilowatt hours. So if you think about it, those two off-the-shelf products give you either 4 hour or up to 8 hour storage. And depending on how you want to operate it, if you had a 100 kilowatt 4 hour package, but you want a 6 hour package, you operate it at two-thirds the value, 66 kilowatts for 6 hours. Now we're looking at what we call energy center designs, which are stationary products that can be very large. They can be 25 or 50 megawatt modules. So then it becomes a question for some of the designers of how big of an electrolyte package do we put in place. And of course that gets down to what's the reliability that you want to ensure and all of this. So at the end of the day, we have a lot of options that we can bring. We actually have designed and are going into bid on some 100 megawatt packages that are 6 hours, which is 600 megawatt hours. when you get to that kind of a situation and have anything over one cycle a day, and even if you're at one cycle a day, I think we're going to be very, very competitive. So we're very I think, fortunate to have the technology now that's been developed over quite a long period of time and proved as well.
There's a solar company in San Diego called Pi Energy, and they are targeting, and it took me a long time to get this out of them, but a nickel a watt, and so a reduction of 5 to 10 times, you know, one-fifth to one-tenth of what currently solar is going for, and they still have work to do, but I'm rooting for them, and I think they're going to get there. They've made a lot of progress in the last couple of years, but what they have to have for their product ultimately is some place to store it.
Yeah,
because they're going to make it cheap, but you need to put it somewhere and take it when you need it.
Yeah, no, I think this becomes one of the things, one of the segments that I would say the iron flow battery works really well with, because what we found with some of the utilities we're talking to and some solar developers is that we're in a situation where the products, the actual solar facilities, they last a long time. But the storage that people look at with primarily lithium ion, you've got to augment it, you've got to replace it, you've got to do all that over time, and of course you get immediate degradation. We get no degradation and we last for at least 25 years. The thing that we don't know right now, frankly, is how much longer than 25 years our product goes. And we've had testing done with the Department of Energy where we have tested our product for 40,000 cycles. And it's both shallow testing and deep cycle testing. And there was zero degradation after 14,000 cycles. When you look at 14,000 cycles, this takes you almost 40 years of a single cycle a day, which is the guarantee you get with lithium ion. If you were only cycling during the weekdays, that's 56 years. And the DOE, when they found the results, they said, well, let's stop at 14,000 cycles. We're not seeing any degradation. And so they did, but they wanted to see if there's any degradation of the cathodes. And because of the technology that's been put together and patented for this product, there was zero degradation on the cathodes because of the particular voltage levels that we design it for. So I can tell you, we'll give a guarantee of 25 years. We don't know how long it's going to last.
That's exciting. I'm going to step back from ESS a little bit and talk about climate change and ask you what your aha moment was where you started realizing that this industry you were in, that you were a part of, energy, was part of potentially, you know, ending the planet, at least as we know it.
Great question. And I'm actually going to take you back before I was ever working and tell you what my aha moment about the environment was. Because this goes back to when I was in high school in the Los Angeles area. And we took a trip up to Big Bear Mountain. And of course, people who know the LA Basin know Big Bear's not that far away. And you get up into Big Bear and it's just beautiful. And then we looked back down, and this was a fall day, into the valley. And I almost had a heart attack because I couldn't see anything. I mean, literally, it was so brown and so thick. There was no buildings that you could see. There was no horizon other than smog. The smog effect literally told me something's got to happen because we're going back down and breathing all this stuff. So that was one of the aha moments about be attuned to the environment. From a work standpoint, early in my career, I mean, we saw gasoline shortages. If you didn't have the right license plate, you know, with the right number on the right day, you couldn't buy gasoline. We saw a power plant fuel use act that restricted the use of natural gas in a power plant. We were having to use fuel oil in these power plants. And then as I took over responsibilities for system planning for the expansion of our high voltage grid, one of the aha moments was I discovered the power of the grid to do good. The power of the grid to do good. And part of that was the connection between the Pacific Northwest and the Pacific Southwest by extra high voltage transmission lines, the Pacific Intertie. that brought excess hydro from the Northwest down to the Southwest. Well, guess what that meant? Zero emission power. We could back off on oil or natural gas or whatever we were using. And all of a sudden, people were better off in both areas. And so we had this connection because of the capabilities of the grid. What then happened was sort of another aha moment was our company was pursuing approval of a large nuclear plant. Nuclear has zero emissions, but doesn't always have full support of everybody. Well, at that particular time, it was the early days of people questioning the policy around nuclear power. So I was responsible for designing the grid, the high voltage grid, to bring that power in most efficiently. Did our job there. That nuclear plant was canceled. And all of a sudden, we had a big hole in our resource plan. And we used the plans that we had for the grid and started reaching out to Arizona, built a 325-mile long 500 kV transmission line, and created a pathway of 1,000 megawatts to connect us to other sources. And by connecting to off-system sources, we were able to then reduce the use of fuel oil and natural gas in our system, do it at a cost that was much better than what we were using, and capture excess nuclear from another region and excess energy that was coming out of a lower cost region. So the power of the grid to do good was spectacular. And that led to some additional things that we can talk about later that were even more important to the renewables future.
I just had a memory that I have to get out while I'm thinking about it. It's a little bit off topic.
Sure.
But I remember when there was a Southwest power outage, and that hadn't happened before, where all of San Diego went dark, not just San Diego, and SDG&E was cleared of all wrongdoing, no blame.
2011.
But
remember it well.
I think something that really impressed me was when you stood in front of the press while the outage was going on and explained to San Diegans what was really happening and showed a mastery of understanding how the power of the grid to do good, how you kind of walked everybody through it.
Yeah, that was sort of an epiphany moment because we had the entire city of San Diego blacked out. I still remember the television interview. I had like 42 cameras in front
of
her.
They were going over the internet because people's televisions were dark.
That's correct. You know, I was wondering who's actually looking at this. And at the end of the day, it was all over the internet. And lots of people were listening to the radio. So they had their, battery charge radios, this kind of thing. And there's news channels that had some backup power, but they weren't connected to the grid anymore. And so we walked them through how we were going to restore the power. And in a step-by-step basis, from black start to bringing it up to interconnecting with the rest of the grid. But we also answered the hard question of, why did this happen? What happened here? And part of what happened is a problem that started in Arizona with someone not following an operating procedure, blacked out a 500 kV line, shifted power into all the other lines, and another system was not operating within the guidelines that had been established by the Western Electric Coordinating Council and the operating systems. That resulted in a cascading outage that should have never happened. And so at the end of the day, everybody had a big review of all of that on a second-by-second basis. We actually went back and put our models together and proved what happened on every single power line, fraction of a second by second. At the end of the day, the real key was we were able to put this back together in much shorter time than we ever thought because we started leaning and connecting with the high voltage integrated grid in all of the Western U.S. and we brought the power back very quickly.
Now that was my non-climate change, climate champion question. No more softballs.
Oh, thank you. Okay.
So how do you talk about climate change to other people and try to explain what's going on to them?
Yeah, the climate change, when you think about the Earth, essentially it gets warmer or it gets cooler in cycles that are natural cycles related to the solar system and our travel around the sun. And this has been going on since millennia. So you have a natural element to it for warming or cooling. We've seen this in the Earth's crust. We've seen it in the records that the scientists have brought forward. But the second part of this is really that there are man-made impacts on climate change that can accelerate or decelerate these changes. And so the question becomes, are we doing anything to accelerate or decelerate? Almost all the science says we as mankind are contributing to the more rapid warming. So I think that the challenge becomes, how do we offset that? How do we put us back to at least neutral so that we don't have the climate effects? And a lot of people think about climate change as just warming. It is way beyond this. And the reason I say it's so far beyond this is that, you know, every piece of plant life on the planet is impacted in some way. The coral in the sea is bleached out and changes the patterns of the fisheries in so many parts of the oceans. The melting of the glaciers is something that I think, you know, we all fear from the standpoint of if you travel around the planet, and I've had a chance with my wife over the last few years to do more traveling than we ever had before. There are literally billions of people who are living on the coastal regions of our planet. These are not rich people. In so many cases, this is subsistence. And if we get decent sized changes in not only the sea level, but the tides and also the weather events that we have, I think you're going to find that we're going to displace, you know, hundreds of millions of people, and it will be one of the bigger challenges for all of mankind. Mankind is going to adjust one way or the other to climate change. Our piece of trying to make this adjustment is let's offset whatever we've done as quickly as possible to get us back to a natural rhythm, and then figure out how do we adjust to the natural rhythms.
Can you tell me why it's personally important to you? And it sounded to me when you were talking about the coral being bleached and the travel, that was getting into a personal feeling.
Absolutely, and the most important thing for us when I think about the personal impact is we actually think about our grandkids. I don't think about, you know, the level in between, but I think about the grandkids because they're going to be a couple generations behind, and if we can't get our handle around this, we'll be in a situation where we have the unfortunate view that our grandkids are going to be dealing with this in a way that no one else has wanted to deal with it. So at the end of the day, we are in a situation where we worry about the next generations. But I also think that from my own personal standpoint, everything I love to do, whether it's sailing or snorkeling, running, golfing, hiking, or stargazing, requires clean air and clean water. And we need to be in a situation where climate change is at least contained so that we can adapt to it over time. I think the effects of a global and societal level are the things that also drive my personal thoughts about how we can do things that will help us offset these changes rather substantially. One of the things that my wife and I have done is lead an opportunity to develop a astronomical observatory in the Great Basin National Park. And that observatory we funded with a number of other private funds to put this observatory in place, and we turned it on about 2 years ago, and now it's being used as a teaching aid for future students and also professors of astrophysics in many different universities. Essentially, it's free access for them, for the partner universities, and they need clear skies. And this happens to be the first astronomical observatory in a national park in the United States. And we're very proud of it, and we're very proud that the universities are using this to help the next generation. But if you if you don't get a hold of climate change and you get particulate matter that's in the air and some of the things we will see, then we're not going to be seeing the stars unless you're launching satellites to all the time to look at what's going on in the universe as well.
Okay. How about any setbacks on your personal or professional journey?
Oh, I think there always seems to be setbacks. When I think back to some of the more substantive ones, the ones that come to mind were the delays that have often occurred in the entire permitting process that we've had for infrastructure projects, especially the ones that would help reduce environmental impacts, that would reduce greenhouse gases, reduce particulates, improve water quality. And when you think about that, they're oftentimes related to renewable energy. So if you have the vast deserts of the Pacific Southwest available for solar, for the most part, how do you get it into the big cities? You need transmission lines. You need high voltage transmission. And we see that, for sure, not everybody likes to have one anywhere close to them, and they want to find other ways. But sometimes the infrastructure of 500 kV lines or above is really what you need to move lots of power. And we've seen lots of delays in those kinds of systems and proposals that could have accelerated the reduction of greenhouse gases. The other thing that we do have to think about, though, is that, and I've seen some direct impacts of this, is that sometimes there are major legislative efforts that sort of want to do a big bang, that to get everything done at once, to get all the renewables in, all of the energy storage, all of the wind, whatever it can be to solve the problem. And what we do have to think about is that the systems that have been in place for decades need to absorb this change, whether it's the infrastructure, it's the change in technology, it's the customer aspects of this, and the cost aspects. You just can't throw hundreds of billions of dollars at something and say, well, it's because of the environment, because no one's going to be able to afford it. So you have to have a ramp rate that people say, this will do the trick, and we're going to work as quick as we can, but we also have to absorb the changes. And sometimes that doesn't always work, and the pace of change is very important.
You know, you said a couple of things that I wanted to respond to. In general, I agree. I think it's good that people have goals to have a lot of renewables, because I think that's going to push it forward. And not having those goals, I think, would slow it down. However, I think you need to know how to do it before you do it. You can't just solve it with money. You really need to solve it with the right technology. Like you talked about, your technology combined with PICE, mm-hmm. a team I used to be on, along with renewables, can replace diesel. So project and save money while they do it. So a project like that, it seems like those should just be done.
Absolutely.
As fast as we can.
Yeah.
We can already save money while we're meeting our environmental goals.
Absolutely. And those are the kinds of things that are smaller in scope and focus, and they're focused on the customers or small ends of the utility grid that really can benefit immediately from situations like that. So I think there, with the large systems, there is this pace of change. Like, for instance, our batteries have this sweet spot of long duration. Well, why wouldn't we consider taking these batteries and hooking them up to lithium ion short duration when the needs of the grid require some high power requirements short term, but also get the great benefits of a longer term duration product like this, like we have at ESS. So at the end of the day, these are the kinds of things that have to happen. And I will tell you the biggest challenge that our company and companies in our space have right now is almost every single developer or every single company that is specing an RFP leaves out our product, not only our product, but the space, because we're still trying to educate people about the availability of this product. I'll give you a specific example. One of the products that we're finalizing the negotiations on, we've essentially won the bid, in a South American country, came out with a bid, and the bid said, we're going to go after energy storage for a two-hour product. It must be lithium ion, and that was like the spec. And so we went back to them and said, oh, by the way, we can give you a product that doubles or triples your benefits with the same kilowatts, but just happens to have 2 to 3 times the amount of energy for a lower price. Would that work for you? And so I think our challenge is, how do we educate the consultants and the companies that are putting the bids out to make sure they don't limit their possibilities by only speccing lithium ion? Don't be technology specific. Give other products and hybrid systems the opportunity to compete.
I'm on a team. I'm the advisor of this storage team at a company that I won't name because I think this is confidential. And they're in the finals of a battery project, and the battery is specced as lithium ion. That's it.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and one thing you asked me about on where did we have a rock bottom moment, I'll tell you a really personal one. We had it in 2017. And we have a home our home is outside of Houston, about 25 miles north in a beautiful community of Kingwood. And our house was destroyed by Hurricane Harvey, which people ask, well, how close to the coast are you? We're 70 miles from the coast. And this particular storm, which that year there was plenty of hurricanes, devastated Puerto Rico, Florida, some of the East Coast, and lots of Texas. We ended up with 52 inches of rain at our house over a multi-day period. But that wasn't what actually did us in. Even though we're 70 miles from the coast, things were draining out. The water got very, very close to our house. But then the reservoirs that were upstream of us 15 miles couldn't handle all the water, and they were released, and people downstream didn't necessarily know the water was coming, and it wiped out our entire subdivision. Everybody had 3 to 4 feet of water in their homes, and so we've been in the rebuilding process, and fortunately we're rebuilt and hoping that we can get things under control for the future.
Well, I'm sorry to have made you go through thinking about that. I guess I will try to help out by asking you to talk about your big successes, happy things.
Happy things. Well, you know, there's a lot of things. I've been very, very fortunate in my career to have worked with a lot of great people, and we've also had some great organizations. A couple of the, I'll name a few things that I would say we're very proud of, but the ability to move large organizations towards beneficial innovations, especially in our industry, is critical now, much more so than it was when I first started in the energy business. And for us to have been noted at San Diego Gas and Electric as the most innovative utility in the industry for 3 straight years because of how we were responding to renewables, storage, electric vehicles, how we got out in front of things, how we were dealing with the devastating fire situation in California, all of those things that we put great technology towards and new systems was very, I think, rewarding for our entire team. The ability to work with our industry colleagues at the C-level area and regulators to adapt our systems and move forward after the tremendous shortages that California had from deregulation back in a few years back has really been, I think, one of the exceptional movements and exceptional successes. From an infrastructure standpoint, I would have to say the fact that I had close involvement in our teams with constructing 2 very long, very large, multi-thousand megawatt capacity transmission lines. We called them the Southwest Power Link and the Sunrise Power Link. In the face of tremendous opposition, is probably a real highlight, because at the end of the day, those lines are filled with renewable energy.
That's where it's all coming from. That's,
every yeah. moment of the day. And so we have changed lives with and you know done a big part there. I also The other two things I would just say is completion of the Great Basin Observatory that we've been involved with on a sort of a charitable basis has been great. And finally, working with ESS as the cleanest energy storage battery on the planet is something we're hoping to make a very, very big success.
So when you put ESS as energy storage out there and the falling prices of solar and wind, what do you think the vision of the future is?
Well, you know, I think about the vision of the future as being something where we have offset the elements of greenhouse gases that have happened over the years. And from my standpoint, the vision comes down to a couple simple things. One, we need to completely drive down the emissions levels that we have in our society and the customer costs, because we can do it with solar, wind, and energy storage over time. And you have to do this with a complete and seamless integration of infrastructure, control systems, and customer response to allow this to happen. So all the pieces have a piece to play in the puzzle of driving down emissions and driving down customer costs.
I agree. Do you have any questions for me?
You know, I guess the question I would have is, as thinking about one of the biggest challenges for a new technology in this business is, how do you think we should get our message out in the most efficient manner to the consultants of the world, the utilities of the world that need to know about an option that they now have that they did not have before, that may make sense as a standalone option for longer duration, 3 hours plus, 3 to 8 hours seems to be our sweet spot, or as a hybrid option that works with shorter term lithium?
The answer for me is very easy. You get interviewed by Lee Cravat on the Climate Champions podcast, and thousands of people listen, or at least five, because my mom and dad said they listen, and my wife and my two brothers. So five people will hear that message. Let's face it, you know this. You have been having success. Success breeds success. The more use cases you have where you can show what you've done, the more success you're going to have. And as long as you don't stumble, and there's always that danger of, with flow batteries, there's always a fear of leaking. You know, if you leak, then that's a big problem. If the systems continue to perform without issues, then that product will shine, especially with you as chairman of the board.
Well, I appreciate that. And I'm going to, you just named a common concern that people have is, what if they leak? So the interesting thing about our electrolyte is it is water, salt, and a dose of iron. At the end of the day, you can actually drink it if you want to.
I'm not going.
Yeah, I know, but you can. Not in big quantities. At the end of the day, we have no hazardous materials. We have no hazardous chemicals. And so you don't even need a collection around this type of electrolyte. And we have very easy plumbing parts, I would call it. So, and we have a tank that is PVC that's plenty thick enough to hold just about everything. So I think what we're finding is that with systems that have been in place since 2015, even our original systems, we've never had a power module failure in that period of time. And the DOE results with the thousands and thousands of cycles are really giving us confidence. And frankly, the proof is in the pudding. And when you get somebody like Munich Re to give you an insurance product that is the only insurance product for a flow battery in the world that we're aware of, that's pretty darn good.
You know, I met those guys and I specifically asked them if they were insuring your product, and they said they were in discussions with you.
Yep.
This was about a year and a half ago, I think, at ESNA. Okay, do you have anything else you want to say?
Lee, this has been a great opportunity to discuss a lot of things related to climate change, but I guess my message would be I'm very passionate about the engineering discipline, the engineering profession, but I would say to all of our current and future engineers, scientists, and computer specialists that climate change is a worthy adversary and success is a worthy goal. that really requires the best minds working together across disciplines. There isn't one silver bullet that's going to solve this, but it's going to take a large cadre of the best people around to get the integration to really attack and make a change on climate change.
Well, that was beautiful. And with that, is it okay if I wrap it up?
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm going to wrap it up with a rap, so bear with me. Mike Nigley had a career that can impress. He was the COO of SDG and chairman of ESS. He likes to hike and snorkel and jog, and then he got to see LA affected by the smog. Now, Mike knew he could make a difference, and he should, so he harnessed the power of the grid to do good. Listen, it's liquid, but have no fears. They know it works for at least 25 years. Mike loves stargazing and also loves to sail. To keep it all clean, we need storage. The Holy Grail. Thank you, Mike.
My pleasure. Thank you, Lee. The Holy Grail is out there.
Longtime listeners may have noticed that Mike was silent after my rap. Perhaps he was stunned by how amazing it was. Perhaps he was shocked by the ineptitude of my skill. Perhaps he was just being polite and waited for me to shut off the recording prior to telling me how much he enjoyed it. Well, if you know Mike, always polite and respectful, it was the latter. Stay tuned for the last few seconds of James Henry Bedell's original Climate Champion Tunes. Until next time.